And you're a replacement show, care of www.vinnyeastwoodshow.com, reporting from the lovely South Island or Hobbitville, and all the things that are going out there in the world of Orcish, which in New Zealand we don't believe actually occurs, because we're little hobbits and we think it's all great and sweet and nothing bad ever happens. And the world is a simple place, and that media can always be believed. But of course, that's not actually a particular case at the moment. And what's going to happen today is we are going to turn around. The focus of the show today is actually going to be looking at the Charlie Hevivo, pardon my pronunciation, shooting in France, working back to Sydney, and then working back to some of the history of Islamic terrorism and the manipulation going on there. However, what we'll also turn around and do is we get time as we'll look a little bit about some of the events going on in EurAsia and the unfolding, what I call the hot cyber war that's going online, or happening out there in the world of cyberland. But before we do that, I'm just going to kind of give you guys a few little bit of housekeeping. This is basically the second season of the show this year. We hope to have next week, we are going to have the arch wizard. It used to be the wizard, but now it's the arch wizard of New Zealand. We'll be talking about the fun revolution. Then we'll be speaking to Jeff Witherson, basically about some interesting things about happening with whales and dolphins and something a little bit more holistic. We're going to be talking to Tim Ryan about sustainability. We hope to get David Fisher, investigative journalist of the New Zealand Herald, on board. We're going to be talking to Professor Paul Buchanan, a private consultant for intelligence and a former US defense intelligence analyst, and we'll be getting some of his perspective on the geopolitics of the world. Evelyn Gilbert, she'll hopefully join us throughout the year as well from time to time, and hopefully she'll be joining us today. We know she's out there, but we don't know. Technology doesn't seem to be our friend today. So this is what we got planned for this year and many, many, many other interesting shows actually coming up. We've now got our website actually up, which is www.postmanproductions.org. Do actually go and have a big explore through there, because I've quite started some investigative news and all sorts of other great things that are happening down here in the South Island. But also basically means is that what I do is I've got my Postman Investigate Facebook page, which I tend to update on a daily basis. So all the updates are there. And basically, you can go and check out every day what I actually turn around and put up on that Facebook site. And so we've got some really good stories there, and some really good information comes on board there as well. During this year, hopefully in about the next couple of months, I'll also be launching a book based on the show, which is going to be simply the Postman Almanac Show. What I've basically done is all the shows and NPS that I've actually had on board, corresponding Facebook pages, I put all together as a nice little 100-page e-book, which we'll basically have available on the website and five of these pages for me on his site as well. So if you want to follow some of these shows and get into a bit more in depth, then that'll be basically a good little tool for you to actually have. So that's what we've actually got planned for this year. And so without further ado, let's turn around and have a look at some of the interesting things that have actually occurred with Charlie Hevivo. As we know, about 2 days ago, so the official verdict goes, three men turned around and they went into the offices of Satire Comic in France that had a history of basically pushing Islamic buttons, and they proceeded to carry out a massive shooting of basically 12 witnesses before driving off, killing a few policemen, and then disappearing into the great distance. This is one of those stories where you basically, I was willing to accept that, this is actually, these were genuine terrorists. I know a little bit about the history of France, especially Paris, it's political hippie, terrorism attacks do occur there. Also, if you're actually going to have a look at my Facebook page there, I've got a posting up there which I've titled French Islam and the Puppet Masters, Who Pulls the Strings of a Politics of Tension. And before we get into the technical reasons why the Charlie Hevivo situation doesn't occur, I'm just going to kind of read you through some of the highlights. This is actually from an extract from an article I wrote for Nexus Magazine in 1996. Actually, since then, this article has actually been translated into over a dozen languages. It's got, I lost count last time, I think somewhere in the 50,000-60,000 hits of variations of this article have been posted at variations. So it's been quoted. David Icke's quoted it. Journalist at Brisbane University has quoted this article. It's probably one of my favourite ones. One of the first professional pieces I ever wrote, and it still remains one of my favourite pieces. And I hit it off with a title called, or a quote for the article saying, if Jesus Christ was to stand up today, he'd be gunned down cold by the CIA for my favourite band, The Other Armageddon Days, Mind Bomb Album Records, 1991. They also did the great classic one, Lords of the West, and they talk about God doesn't plant the bombs in Rome, but I digress. basically, the article which I said penned in 1996, I write, in Algeria and France, the current Islamic hotspots, the Islamic guerrillas likewise have been encouraged by forces with ulterior motives. Fundamentalists are receiving intelligence and logistical support from right-wing elements within France's own governments. To date, Jean-Louis Debré, the French Interior Minister, has been accused by the police judiciary, the French version of the CIB, of misdirecting security forces for political motives. Likewise, the French police have been accused of cooperating with the Spanish state of creating GAL, the anti-terrorist liberation group, death squads in their war against the leftist and Basque separatists. Witnesses called upon to give evidence have stated that the French police, right-wing extremists, police informers, and former OAS, the French terrorist organization opposed to Algerian independence, members assisted with GAL's operations with France. The revelation of the OAS's involvement puts another perspective upon the Algeria-related terrorist attacks within France and Algeria itself. The OAS's connections to the fundamentalists of Algeria is not new. In 1961, senior OAS commander Jean-Jacques Cecini, and I'm sorry, but I speak a terrible British French, discussed with the CIA Paris station officer the possibility of Franco-Muslim alliance. The outcome, according to available material, is that the CIA's OAS Muslim Republic was cut short, for President Kennedy, on the advice of his political advisors, cancelled the covert assistance program before it could begin. However, after the assassination of Kennedy in 1963, it is known that the CIA's use of covert operations programs increased on a dramatic scale. There is no reason to conclude that the CIA did not take advantage of the situation to utilize the OAS and non-governmental Muslim assets. This would ensure that neither the French Republic nor a Soviet-controlled government obtained control of the Algerian oil fields. The French have long accused American oil companies of having encouraged the USA's support of the OAS and the Muslim rebels. The OAS, though, was not the only inbred resistance organization of the era, for during the Algerian crisis, another organization came to be known. Like the OAS, it comprised of individuals with anti-Soviet, pro-Catholic beliefs and the same desire to rid France of Charles de Gaulle. The organization is not cited in the book Target de Gaulle, however, from its connections to the Vatican and the pro-Nancy activists, both of which I may point out are very much targets of Charlie Habibo, the magazine. They didn't just attack Islam, they attacked repeatedly Vatican, they attacked pro-Nazi activists. And if you actually look at my Facebook page, you'll see I've got several of the front page of their articles on my Facebook page, which shows their attack on the Vatican, which is in connection to both the Vatican Guard, which is obviously backed by the Medici banking cartel, and also some references to pseudo-Masonic organizations. In fact, we'll carry on from that point because, going back to the article, its possessions detailed accurate intelligence on the very inner workings of de Gaulle's government. It is possible to surmise that this secret society was, in fact, an organization known as El Gledo, meaning Latin for the sword. Also, their logo, interestingly enough, appears on this wetsuit of Andre Novak, kind of gave my pronunciation shocking, of the Norway shooter that carried out the attack in Norway a couple of years ago, at the same time that basically Israel, or Norway, was actually about to launch a moon investigation into Israel and cut off gas supplies to oil supplies to Israel. Quite often, same situation you find in Malaysia. Malaysia just turned around and took Israel to court for genocide. Again, they get hit by these series of attacks. So quite often when you look behind it, this is not just them attacking Islam, but the magazine went beyond that. And as I conclude, in 1990, the Italian Prime Minister Giulio Andreotti briefed the Italian parliamentary on a secret parliamentary paramilitary organization called El Gledo. He explained that Gledo had been set up in 1956 and was run by the CIA to take precautions against communist aggression. In particular, El Gledo was tasked to reduce the influence of communism in France and Italy. Later, this would include Spain via a phrase which came to be known as the strategy of tension, or also known as the politics of tension. Since this revelation, journalists have unearthed the meaning behind this term. It was Gladio's tactics to make use of right-wing mercenaries and mafia hitmen to carry out attacks that were then blamed upon the left. These attacks included the mafia's involvement in the Red Brigade kidnap and murder of the Italian Prime Minister Aldo Moro in 1978. The strategy was utilized with citizens' fear to justify the greater power of the security forces. So that's what I was writing about, what was going on in France in relation to the ménage à trois between Islam, fascism, and the security forces back in the 70s. So we go fast forward three decades to this current attack, and what we see is We've got a different generation of Islamic, for want of a better word, urban peasants being recruited from the ghettos of Paris for a different kind of oil war, which obviously we're talking about Syria and ISIS there. Yet the results remain the same. To use the politics of tension, or the phrase I used before was the strategy of tension, to create a wedge between Islamic Arab states and France, then ruled by liberal power base back then. And of course, what we're seeing with this current attack is that this will see a huge political swing, as happened with the attack in Norway, towards the right. So this will actually benefit the right at the cost of Islamic people. The immigration standards, their religious tolerance, all of these things will go out the window. But back in the 70s, it was actually France that was actually giving the support to the Iran's Ayatollah. And again, you know, another day we'll talk about what actually went on there in terms of the Islamic Jihad, how the Ayatollah was forced into a corner. He had to choose between supporting this connection to France or supporting the Islamic Jihad, who were backed by the populist support. And that if he didn't back them, then he was going to lose that populist support. And if he did back them, of course, he lost the support of France. And for 20 years, Europe and Iran went their different ways. But of course, the goal at the time back then had been driven by the hope that such a support would actually be remembered by Iran and could be used once and for all to break the control the US had at that stage over Europe, in fact still does, economic destiny as a consequence of the post-World War II Britain War Agreement via giving Europe access to cheap Iranian crude. And of course, you know, when we look outside of this, the bigger picture right now going on is the clash between the US and we're back to Cold War days in Russia. And this all boils down to that whole quintessential situation of control of the oil supply, because, you know, at the moment, the way the situation is set up, Russia can turn the taps off in Europe at any stage, and actually see what we're happening at the moment is, you naturally notice, oil prices have gone absolutely radically down, which is incredible, because right now we're seeing as we're going into Northern Hemisphere winter, so those prices should actually be going up, but the Russians are playing their kind of tit for tat, so they're turning, you know, they're giving cheap oil access, so that's pushing the oil price down. So, of course, what we want to try and do is, the Americans want to do is cut the Russians actually off, come up with another alternative, and the best option, of course, would be to turn around and actually have one thing where you're drawing from the Caspian that goes through Syria, which is, you know, the area which under contestment right now, through Iraq, which has already been controlled, and then goes into Turkey. And then what you've got is a pipeline that can't be shut down by either the Russians or the Iranians. Perfect situation. Basically also means that the Americans then have access to cheap oil and they can continue to have that control over Europe. You know, this issue has been a repeated situation throughout the entire period, where every time that it looks like Europe's trying to find an alternative way to come up with cheap oil and a way of undercutting the control of the market, well, from the US, suddenly, and they do this by, you know, trying to reach out, putting out an olive branch normally to Iran, suddenly things tend to blow up. And I'll give you an example. In 2007, we know of the Mumbai Islamic terrorist attacks. If you read carefully at the time, you'd notice that this was occurring as high-level delegates from the European Union were actually meeting in hotels to hotel. And then the attack occurred, and we were told that 10 Pakistani Islamic terrorists were able to shut down not one hotel, not two hotels, a railway station, a mosque, but also managed to run roving ambushes, which just managed to kill the chief of the terrorism squad for the city of Mumbai, who was a man very much against corruption. His aide-de-camp, who was in the vehicle at the time on live television, would state that what he heard, and, you know, this guy full of holes, so he's got no reason to lie, was he heard people speaking, or the terrorists speaking in a northern Punjabi accent. So he's maintaining that the people that attacked, carried out the attack in Mumbai, were Indian. You also refer, if you look at the BBC at the time, they actually noticed that there was more than 10 gunmen. Again, like these guys, they were very well equipped. They had exit strategies supported. But the piece I liked the best was a BBC piece, which actually notes that at the time the shooting broke out in Mumbai, what occurred was that two guys were sitting at a table. One was an Asian guy and another guy was a European with a blonde punk haircut, pulled out their own weapons and started shooting. Now, that report was a very interesting piece because they had five witnesses, first names, last names, where they worked, including the Cafe Leopold, which is a very famous cafe in Mumbai. So, you know, this was a very strong piece of journalism, but I mentioned it and it never got picked up again. But I couldn't find out why were these European Union guys actually at Mumbai. So I had to go back to the business papers, the hard copies. I dug up for 4 months. And what I actually discovered was this amazing situation was that meeting was being held in Mumbai at that time because they were discussing creating a a global currency system which would be backed by the euro, which in turn would be backed by Iranian crude oil, and Asian nations, including Thailand, Indonesia, and Malaysia, we all know what's been happening in Malaysia, own mineral reserves. Suddenly, boom, this attack occurs, Mumbai stock market crashes, and that particular situation is actually put back actually on hold. So, you know, this is the point that we keep seeing back, is it's not just about little guys shooting each other, there's big geopolitics, and that geopolitics always returns to oil. And, of course, the situation that we're talking about, you know, it would please the Saudis if the situation in ISIS, what's happening with ISIS and Syria, it pleases the Saudis that it occurs. It keeps the Russians out. It keeps the Iranians, Saudis, lavish competitors in check. And, of course, you know, it was the Saudis, it was the Israelis, it was the neoconservatives, so, of course, the other group in this, you know, that U.S., you know, group wanting world domination. Those are the three guys that back in the 1980s were recruiting mercenaries that they were then used to fight the Soviets and the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And, of course, where did they recruit these guys? They recruited them from the four ghettos of Europe, from Paris, the Algerian quarter of Paris, from northern Africa, from Algeria, from Cairo. They picked all these poor guys and, you know, all these so-called Islamic, you know, we made that sound like the fanatics. Well, all those guys that are fighting in Syria, ISIS, they all get a wage, and it's a very, very wealthy, considerable wage, and it's all paid for this by the Saudis. So I mention all this stuff because this is the geopolitical situation, so that you don't even need to worry about saying, well, actually, no, those terrorists were actually Mossad agents or whatever, because even if they are terrorists, if you look at where the money trail is and what geopolitics is, Islamic, we know that the history of Islamic militarism is it's actually connected back to that whole right-wing fascist situation. We see it happen time and time again. However, having said all of that, there are a few major inconsistencies that occur on this particular event. And the first thing that struck me when I started reading through the newspapers and reading through them carefully was that we've got this young guy that turns around, he's meant to be the getaway driver, Hamid Morad. Well, he's got all his classmates at the moment busily twitting away saying that he's innocent because they know that he's innocent because he was in the class with him at the time the attack occurred. So that's a really neat trick. How do you be in an attack when at the same time you're in a classroom surrounded by 20 of your peers? But, you know, that's what we've been told. So this guy's actually handed himself in. So, and bear in mind that we're told that the official count by the police was that they're looking for this guy because they believed he was a suspected getaway driver. Go back and look at YouTube. Go back and look at those photos. Look at those photos and look at those video collections. If you notice, the first thing that you actually notice is that you see two gunmen, and you only ever see two gunmen, and when you look at all the witness reports, you don't see them ever saying three gunmen. They even refer to gunmen's plural, they refer to two people. What you do see, however, is you see one of these gunmen gets out of the driver's connection. So in other words, you can see in the very video that the connection that this guy is the getaway driver is flawed because you can see they didn't have a getaway driver. There were only two people in that car, and both of them got out of the front car. You didn't see three people get out of the car. You only saw two, and one of them was the driver. So why wouldn't the third one get out? That would make any sense. So that one just rips that apart in 5 seconds flat. Now, we then also get told that the reason why they managed to identify these guys was that they actually, one of them left an identity card in the car. Well, you read online and you have to be very, very careful because people have made the mistake of saying the words identity cards, plural. They put up one of the gunmen, Sharif Karachi's photo and Sid Karachi, the brother's identity card. If you look at the photos, you can see only one of them is an identity card. That's the one that belongs to Sid. The other one is simply a police handout. So they only left one identity card in the car. Let's go back again. Let's go back and take through the situation. As you're watching the drivers or these two gunmen get out of the car and they move towards the policeman and they carry out the shooting, what strikes me is that they're carrying all the bits and pieces. They get back in the car. Now, these guys are so cool, they're so collected, that as they got out of the car, one of them had kicked a running shoe out of the car and it lands on the pavement. But when they get back in the car, the guy he's so collected, he's able to spot that shoe, pick it up, and put it in the car to drive it away so that he leaves no incriminating evidence behind. You imagine all the DNA and what someone would be in the shoe. So he's clever enough to do that, but then... And they've done everything else, you know, and all the Sky TV and all the major journalists are saying these guys are professional, you know, obviously there's evidence that they're Syrian soldiers, blah, 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 blah. But having done all this, they stop their car, they don't do a sweep of the vehicle, and to find that they're leaving one ID card behind, that's odd enough itself. But, you know, the reality is, if you look at the detail of which how this attack is conducted, the logical thing would be, and this is what I would do when I, you know, having been in the military and been in these sort of situations, that we would actually be saying, don't take anything that it can incriminate with you to begin with. You know? So this is a little bit of a red clearing. But then, you know, it's a pretty cool thing that there just happened to be somebody on site to catch all these cool photos. Well, it turns out that the person, and you gotta turn around and raise your eyebrows about there. The person that actually did that was, I'll spell it for you phonetically because my pronunciation, I got a bit of a blocked nose today anyway. It's Alpha Michael Charlie Hotel Alpha India Stein, the deputy editor of Israel's IBA channel. So there just happened to be an Israeli guy right there taking these fantastic photographs, which incidentally pull apart the whole driver scenario to begin with, just happened to be in the scene. Now, what's also interesting is that CBC, CNN, and IBN are the three mainstream sources, and this is just very quickly, and I'm sure I can find more, have all pointed and noted this link, and they put out articles suggesting that there was perhaps a link to Israel. All those articles have been pulled, and bang, you can go to these sites, you can Google it, you find it, you go there, there's blank. The interesting one is the anchorman, I think it's from CNN, and he points out very clearly, Charlie Hebdo magazine never mocked the prophet. They mocked how the cowards to try to distort this words. So again, you know, it's very easy. Everyone's going to get on board and they're going to make a big deal. All the cartoons out there and cartoon land are turning around and, you know, drawing pictures of Islam and, you know, solidarity to these amazing, brave people standing up to these fanatical Islamic fundamentalists, Ali Allah Akbar. But the magazine itself didn't just attack Islam. And the article I like is actually, it's a picture and it's got the editor and he's got his magazines all wrapped around him. And he's got a push button, but he's also got the Star of David behind. And actually, if you look throughout the entire magazine, you find that one of the recurring themes is not just the situation of you should be able to turn around and criticize religion, whether it's Judaism, Islam, whatever, but it's the point of the double standard of the media, which says, hey, it's okay to point the finger at those savage, barbarian Islamic people, but if you turn around and start pointing the finger at Israel, oh no, you're anti-Semitic. Now, two cases we can point. This is, you know, you read the ODT today, and that was saying the same situation, and they'll be going on about it in New Zealand, freedom of the press, blah, blah, blah. Two examples I'd like to point out to you. One is my very good friend, Trace Hodgkins, who basically no longer, you know, this guy's award-winning cartoonist, won New Zealand Cartoonist Award 2 years in a row. You basically don't see his work anymore in any of the newspapers in New Zealand, predominantly because he's been blacklisted. And it largely got himself off-site because he drew a picture of John Key with a long nose, and it was called anti-Semitic. You know, the question is, we know that John Key is Jewish. I don't particularly have a problem if he's Muslim, Jewish, Buddhist. I don't really care. But I think when we deal with situations of Israel, we have a right to know, is the Prime Minister wearing, as he likes to point out, because our Prime Minister doesn't believe that he's a Prime Minister 24-7. He's apparently the Prime Minister 9-to-5, and when he goes home and feeds the cat, he's somebody else. But the question we want to know is, when the Prime Minister deals with something that happens with Israel, is he wearing his Prime Minister's hat or is he wearing his little Jewish cap on his head? Likewise, when he's dealing with America, is he the America or is he the guy that's got a US passport? Oh, no, that's right, he won't answer. When you ask him information, he won't tell us whether he's got a passport. But these are questions which are about a balanced media being able to ask these questions and demand replies from these people. But we don't answer that in that case. And instead, Trace is now in political wilderness because he's dead pissed off John Key. And he told me directly, and I've got this in my book pointing out, that, you know, he would write a cartoon and John Key would directly ring up the editor and then the editor would chew him out. Of course, the other evidence on that, of course, is another very famous cartoonist that you don't see anymore. And I got an article, and I'll dig it up and I'll put it up on my website at some stage. It was actually a piece that award-winning journalist Malcolm Evans also wrote for me. He wrote specifically for my magazine Deadline, which again points out the situation when he got basically blacklisted off New Zealand media for putting anti-Israeli cartoons. And this is a very key point about Charlie Hebdo. They were not only attacking Islam, they repeatedly attacked Israel, and Israel is as big a suspect as Islamic ISIS fundamentalists, especially when we turn around and look at the situation where we can't actually find evidence that directly links these guys supposedly to Syria. What we do have is pictures taken by Israeli editors of two gunmen, not three gunmen, that are so clever that they can actually carry out all this amazing military strategy, but then they make the most basic fundamentalist raw recruit mistakes that you'd ever occur. And it's just the whole image is inconsistent. Now let's turn around and jump continents. And let's step to the situation, and obviously it's not going to occur to us today, so I'm just going to go solo. let's shift to the Southern Hemisphere and look at the timing. This attack has occurred at the same time as we've also seen attacks occur in Australia against so-called ISIS, Islamic fundamentalists, which have got Australians running around going, left behind going, oh, Islam is terrible, oh, you know, we've got to go to Syria, we've got to sort these guys actually out because they're just barbarians. Propaganda, you know, absolute propaganda. John Pilch, of course, today points out actually that the people that actually did the shootings or did the killings in the Elite Cafe attack in Sydney were, in fact, the Australian police. I'll be following up on it myself further. But more importantly, one of the things I pointed before we even knew when that actually occurred was I turned around and said, based on what I put on my Facebook pages approximately about two to three months ago, was I pointed out the fact that I said at that time, I was saying, I bet you this gunman turns out to be a mentally ill patient. And this is one of the things that I pointed out. I said that because about 2 months beforehand, I put up a post on my Facebook page, and I was taking slightly the piss out of the Australian government. I had a picture of Tony Abbott in a straight jacket going, I hear voices, kill, kill, kill. And I had a picture of Santa Claus being forced down by an Australian jet. The entry I'm looking for is basically, new study shows you're crazy if you believe people are trying to brainwash you. Basically, I pointed out the fact that in the case of you know, our media, we're completely surrounded by this anti-Islam situation. Yet when we actually turned around, we started to look at all the situation, what was happening in Australia, even before the shooting, we had about six to eight cases where basically the shooters were decreed or made out to look like they were Islamic fundamentalists in the media when they were shot by police. And it turned out in all eight cases that the people actually involved were not Islamic terrorists. They were actually mentally ill people. And what I actually pointed out wasn't just that these people were actually being turned around and that they were targeting people that were mentally ill, but what ASIO was doing was that they were running a policy in the refugee camps where basically what occurred was they were sort of saying to people, well, we're not going to let you out until you change your attitude. So then what occurred was that people changed their attitude. They were given information to the ASIO that they thought ASIO wanted to cure. They were finding that people that were actually had nothing to do with Islam at all but were drug suspects were going, we'll go to choice, you know, turn around, say I'm an Islamic terrorist or whatever, take 3 months instead of, hey, I'm a drug dealer, I'll take 6 months. So they basically constructed a whole Islamic threat that didn't actually exist. We also, of course, you know, when you turn around, you actually tend to look at what actually in Australia, what actually occurs in the fundamentalist violence in Sydney. You know, most of it's not actually carried out by Islamic fundamentalists at all. It's actually carried out by basically the descendants of the 400 Christian phalangists that John Howard's government actually led into Australia, that were the people that were basically mercenaries that had carried out the rapes and massacres in Palestinian camps, 10,000 people killed in one day, that were basically fled to Australia because they didn't want to be done on war crimes, and they came, Howard let them straight on in, and these are the guys that became the meanest, nastiest dogs in the drug world and the underbelly in Australia. You'd have to see underbelly to, you know, confirm that. Yet, they've created this absolute propaganda myth in Australian media for the last 15 years that supposedly any rape, murder, atrocity that occurs if they've got dark skin, it must be an Islamic person. When that's actually not the case. We then turn around and we saw these hostage situation occur in Lint, which was convenient. Poop made a very big deal about he was demanding an ISIS flag because apparently, you know, this terrorist can't work out how to use the internet and print something off the internet. The whole thing was ludicrous. And then, of course, what did eventually emerge is something that I said would occur, which I wrote, you know, 2 months beforehand. Turned out that the guy that actually carried out the attack wasn't even a fundamentalist. He was just a sick guy. And, of course, you know, if you are mentally ill, it's a lot easier to push you in one direction and get you to come across to something than when you're a sane person. Because, of course, that's what terrorism rules on. It rules on the whole manipulation of manipulating the stupid and the angry. And if you're watching the news and you just want to listen to what Fox is telling you, then guess what? You all have been proof that brainwashing works. And this is the real danger. What's going to happen, I feel, is the sad part about Charlie Hebdo, is that really the question shouldn't be about, you know, we're going to see a lot of liberal magazines, we're going to swing over, we're going to see that it's okay to attack or lampoon Islam. But again, of course, as the magazine Charlie Hebdo pointed out itself on its beautiful picture of a guy holding two magazines, one's got a picture of the Muhammad and the the TV camera is actually out in front of him with a microphone and wants to go hear say, and the cameraman's laughing. And the second one is of basically a person taking the mickey out of Israel, and the same media person this time is no longer laughing, but has actually got his hand firmly clamped over the face of the satirical magazine. So this will be the sad thing of that point that Charlie would be able itself was trying to make this forgotten. Then there's no solidarity going on here. It's just a further, very clever psychological operations carried out to further basically allow that bum routine to go, so that we end up going right back to the good old days of World One and World War Two. Remember the, you know, Huns stabbing babies, and it's that basic, and we're falling for it. And hopefully our media, or at least our counterculture media, which is as us, is smart enough to make people aware of the fact and they don't buy this particularly set of lies. So that has been my coverage on that whole particular issue of unfolding right there at the moment. And of course, you know, the last final situation is, as I point out on my Facebook page, which will become part of my Postman Almanac and is on my website repeatedly, even if you turn around and you don't want to accept the fact that the guys that were carrying out the attacks were false flag, you know, the reality is we know from who ISIS is armed, from that money trial that exists, and even the mainstream media is now accepting that the people that are actually arming these poor urban peasants are the Saudis. It's the neoconservatives, and it's the Israelis. And they've been doing this since the 1980s. And why anyone, you know, it's like, how many times do these guys have to get their hands caught in the cookie jar before people start to wake up that they're kind of being conned? So, you know, that was my take on this particular current unfolding episode happening in France and the historical background of it. I've got lots of material. I mean, it even involves New Zealand. You know, as I said there before, I kind of move on to the next subject and we get towards the break time. Like, you know, I've got a big picture of this Antonov landing in New Zealand. It's landing about September. The plane itself, you can trace back to New Zealand 2003 when it's been loaded up to take New Zealand soldiers to fight Islamic troops in Afghanistan. The plane this time round is actually owned by a guy called Simon Spitz, an Israeli, for want of a better word, crook, who was operating in New Zealand in 1991 before he fled New Zealand, having basically embezzled $12 million of companies. Was caught on UK TV admitting that he was actually arming Muslim fundamentalists. These airplanes have been operating in and out of New Zealand for over, like, you know, nearly 20 years, arming Islamic fundamentalists. And these are the same airplanes that then get paid by our New Zealand Defence Force to take New Zealand soldiers to go off and actually put themselves in situations where we get to watch Kiwi body bags coming back in body bags, all because John Key wants to trade with America. You know, this has got nothing to do with Islam. We don't need to be in a war that's going to last for 30 years, getting sucked into propaganda, which actually ends up with, you know how it's going to end up with? You're going to have ISIS on one side, basically made up of people that live in the poor parts of France and Cairo and in North Africa. And on the other side, you're going to have soldiers from NATO who, generally speaking, soldiers, it's like the Copperhead Road song. You take the white trash and you march them away. Most of the people in the US military, most of the people in New Zealand military, most of the people in the Australian military, they come from lower socioeconomic areas, and they join the military as a means to get out. So what you've actually got is a really great situation where the poor fight the poor so that the few can have the many, which, of course, is one of the things that the magazine Charlie Hebdo was always campaigning against. So, you know, if I was one of the big boys, I'd want to shut them up, and if I could shut them up and then turn around and use it as a propaganda exercise for myself, yay, that's clever psyops by anyone's book. What we'll carry on with, we're going to get started, I imagine we're going to go into break at some stage, but what I'm also going to get turned around and carry on with is what appears at the surface to be an unrelated subject, but I think in some ways is actually more related than is the case. And this, of course, is the disappearance of AirAsia, the third Malaysian-based airline to actually go down, on December the 28th. You know, this was what I was concentrating on before I turned around, and I just had to say something about the whole Charlie Hebdo situation, because, you know, I saw this as just the worst thing in the world, that this magazine that stood for everything but against the ridiculous that in this day and age that religion should be off limits to criticism is going to get sucked into something that's actually basically a tool for the right wing Christian fundamentalists as another way to justify why we should beat up those nasty Islamic people. Bear of course in mind, of course, that, you know, though those nasty Islamic people include Iran, that actually have a very good relationship with France, and the miracle and those powers that keep their nose out of, what actually naturally happens is as natural trading partners, you'd actually see France and Iran would actually be getting along very well. And of course, that also would undermine the whole economics. So it's got to go. But what I was actually saying, going back to the situation with Eurasia, was one of the things, and I'm going to work backwards as well, because one of the things which I got to, diverted from the story to cover this current story, was I started to turn around and look at the situation of the common denominators. And what I perceived was that in MH370 and in the current attack, and a swath of attacks going on in the internet right now, the common denominator was that the hackers were actually targeting the aviation industry. And I start off by pointing out in my Facebook posting that this is what US Congress report itself had actually stated, that hackers were clearly targeting airlines and aircrafts, computers, and sophisticated hacks are motivated by just as much by profit as politics and ideology. My comments on the US Congress report pointed the finger at China, which, of course, it's convenient to do so at the moment. But what I pointed out is whether or not it's China or someone playing a very clever game of plausible deniability, the evidence is that someone was specifically targeting airlines and hacks that were also being used to play the market. And this is what gets kind of interesting, because this is not anything new, but we'll get there eventually. You followed it through, and you know, what I pointed out was that this all occurred in cyber war as a so-called group called the Litizen Squad were carrying attacks on Sunny. So then the next thing happens after the carrier attack on Sunny, which then responds in an attack occurring with the entire internet of Korea, gets shut down, which then responds in an attack on a nuclear power plant in South Korea, a very significant step, because what we've seen in this last couple of months is the cyber attacks have progressed from not being just attacking data and information, taking out websites, disrupting sites, to what they're actually now doing is they're attacking physical infrastructure. We're seeing coordinated across the area that it's all been set up that what's going to be attacked next, and we have another 9/11, I believe that it's going to have a cyber component, and it's going to be actually attacking civil, basically, infrastructure. And the reason being is, of course, that you attack the airlines, you take away transportation, you attack the internet, then they have a reason to turn around and actually take away our access to the internet, and they get a chance to bring in censorship on that element as well. But what was also happening is that after the Lizard turned around and carried out this attack, and suddenly we had tip attack, counter hack, was the Lizard Squad then turned around and they sent a tweet saying that there was a bomb aboard, a Sunny executive's jet. Well, that's kind of weird, because there actually were not one, not two, but three bomb hoaxes conducted against AirAsia that same month that it actually went down. And in fact, if you look at AirAsia, what you discover is that they've had a perfect record. They've had a few minor incidents, but nothing major. But this month alone, they've had up to 9 different incidences actually occur on that airline. And one of those bomb hoaxes was actually, it was suggested on a forum that this was connected to a guy called, or a person that got on site December the 12th, 5 days before the attack, and for about 4 days he was posting regularly, 650,000 people saw a site, don't get on AirAsia because it's been targeted by the Black Hand. When I looked at the situation, Black Hand itself is, it's Chinese slang for, behind the scenes or people that use blackmail. But Black Hand is also interesting because Black Hand was a phrase that was used by Western media from around about 2007-2011, where they talked about cyber attacks. And what it actually corresponded was it corresponded to a cyber attack that occurred against NATO's website during the Kosovo cyber wars of 1998-1999. And it occurred to a hacking group which was called Black Hand. Now, hackers are very specific. They know each other's names. They have legends. So when you say Black Hand and you're a hacker, it's like saying Iceman or Wingman. It's not an accidental. So if he was referring to Black Hand, I think he was actually referring to a hacking group, which turns out did exist. They carried an attack against NATO, and what they were responding to was, in turn, was an attack against the Chinese embassy in Kosovo against Belgrade. So we also saw a Trojan emerge around this time, which is one we're now seeing, which has turned up in the physical infrastructure. Again, this is a pattern that we saw in 9/11, that they had a virus there called Red Alert. It was hitting the waves in the months leading up to the attack. What we now have one called Black Energy. Black Energy is taken off DC Comics. It's a character in DC Comics that fights the Green Lantern there, and its chief bad guy is called Black Hand as well. So we've got this current virus out there called Black Energy. And it's targeting physical infrastructure, and it's going rampant. And again, I've told you, one of the targets it's attacking is airlines, and it's attacking traffic control websites, and potentially, according to at least not one but two former CEOs, it's been used to actually hack airlines. Interesting. This is where it gets interesting too, because we've already got one person turning around saying, you know, AirAsia before the event, up for 650,000 people seeing it, saying don't get AirAsia. But one of my favorite sites, Global Research, they wrote an article. They were quoting InfoWars, and what they said was the InfoWars article entitled "AirAsia CEO Dumps Shares Days Before the Flight to Spain" was mistakenly cross-posted by Global Research and has since been removed. The article suggests the relationships between alleged speculative stock market transactions conducted on December 22 to 23 and subsequent crash of AirAsia flight QZ8501. There was no evidence to that effect, nor is there evidence of foreknowledge of the crash. The trade pertained to the Tune Insurance Holdings, a diverse insurance company which, among other activities, provided online travel insurance for AirAsia passengers. And then it gets into technical details. And what I say is, I turn around, and when I made my post, I turn around and say, hey, I agree with this. It's by itself, it's not a big deal. But what I'd be interested to know is, if we look not so much at the money made, but the money not lost by knowing when to get rid of your chips off the table, that changes. And did it just occur to this company? Or can we find other signs of the securing? Well, yes, is the short version, because if you turn around and look at MH370, there's a guy out there called the site there called the Daily Reckoning, and he points out, very similar to what's happening with AirAsia. Now, he says, MAS has been down in June since the best part of 2008 and fell 80% after Flight 370 went missing March 9th. But you can see a clear break in all new lows February 19th on substantially increased volumes. In other words, marketing discounting future news, the actual event was itself low. To sum that up, what he's actually saying is that shares were being dumped on MH370, that were being dumped before the event occurred. Now, those losses were actually exceeding what we now see loss afterwards. So someone was shilling those events very, very carefully. Now, I'm interested when this has happened, because we've actually seen this before, and we saw this in 9/11. The mainstream media were reporting, they accepted that someone was using terrorism and inside trading was going on, just like, you know, what to play Grand Theft Auto makes the same, you know, case that the sort of thing that goes hand in foot with each other. They had to accept it because there were over 18 different nations before 9/11 that were actually going, hey man, this market's going really crazy, what's going on here? And, you know, so it was a matter of public record that the market was behaving wacko, and that something suspicious, just like happened last 2010, the market behaved in a way that they believed that somebody was doing something very, very shonky back then. But the media then turned around and said, oh, yeah, but that was only worth $20 million, and they didn't even come and get money. Well, what we only actually know about is the money that the terrorists didn't come and get. But if you go and look at a company called Conva, what they did was that they were able to extract 34 computers from the 9/11 site. They only had fragments to work, and from those fragments, they were able to conclude up to $100 million in illegal transactions was laundered through the computers at 9/11 on the day. And that's just from what they were able to find. You know, only 34 computers. So, in actual fact, what we're talking about was we may have actually witnessed, just like Die Hard, a terrorist attack that wasn't a terrorist attack, but in actual fact was one of the biggest bank robberies in mankind history. And of course, everyone who looks at the gold, you know, and so on, will know a little bit about that. That'll add to the picture. But again, this was not something which struck me new. This was actually something that I was actually looking for, because in 1996, I was working in Westpac. I was working in the research division, and I was reading the Sydney Morning Herald, and I noticed this company. They called me the day before, and it was a company that manufactured X-ray machines. And this company's stocks went from $1 to $18 in 24 hours. And what I did was I picked up the phone and I rang around all my contacts in the United States, and who in turn were linked to the security agencies. And I said, you know, what's the deal there, guys? I mean, I know you've got the Olympics coming on and everything, but, you know, things are just a little bit more hot than they should. And the feedback was overwhelmingly, yes, they were. Well, the next day I'm standing in the bank, the bottom level of the bank where I worked, actually, you know, getting money out, funnily enough. I looked up the clock. And the exact time I looked was the time that TW800 went boom, blew up. And it blew up the week that that airline had actually recovered. It had just come back from the black. And the reason why it recovered from the black was a little thing called Lockerbie, which was then TWA, had previously been called Pan Am. Pan Am had blown up in 1987 on Christmas Day. Again, that's a very, very sordid history. And in doing so, it put this company into the black. Now, of course, every single one of these airlines that blows up or gets wiped out because of a terrorist attack, what it does is it concentrates the players. So you end up with greater and greater control of the transportation sector. So now you can control people's movements. You're already controlling their there's censorship because of what's happening on the internet and things like, you know, what's the word that they were using for anyone that turns around and does it? It used to be conspiracy theorists. Now the word is non-violent extremists. So we're now actually, we're not even conspiracy theorists. Now we're non-violent extremists. So you're controlling people's monetary supply, you're controlling people's transport, and you're controlling their ideas. We see again when we look at what, you know, what's happening on the market of interest, and we look at basically both Air Asia and we look at the Malaysian Airlines. If you look at the articles that were occurring beforehand, what you see is that basically the articles are saying the sharks are swarming around those airliners, and they're very specific. They're naming companies that are involved in Saudi-based firms that would love it to buy into those firms. And what they mean buy, what they actually mean is buy them, sack people, chop up all the assets, and wipe out another competitor. Because this is what the whole game is. So that's what I found very, very interesting when I turned around and I looked at the AirAsia incident of late. I mean, there's some other interesting things there, but it was the fact, as I said, money never sleeps. But, well, maybe it doesn't sleep because knowing what it knows, the knowledge of the market keeps it awake at night time. And I have a little nice little graph there of bit that's in the Daily Reckoning below, and I've attached it to Barack Obama announces investigation of unusual stock market activities. This is Gwyn Dwyer also wrote an article at the same time this was occurring throughout the world, including New Zealand. There was a series, I think it was the 17th and up to 23rd, throughout the world, the stock markets around the world were getting, they were the ones that had been specifically targeted. What's moved on now is that they've gone and they've done a test, they've done a probe, they've tested that they can actually hit the stock markets. Now airlines are in firepower. But, you know, it's not just, we're not just seeing airlines that are actually being attacked. And, of course, you know, I'll step back to airlines. At the moment, we're all focusing on AirAsia and we're focusing on Malaysia. But if you turn around and you look at what's actually happening with Virgin, JL, and Qantas, there's a lot of stuff to suggest those airlines are being tested as well. Now, some of this, I'm willing to concede, is because of the fact that Boeing put out a really crack plane, and that's having all signed design faults. But when you turn around and you start looking at Virgin, for example, you've noticed that there's often been reports of a strange smell being tested. In one case, they actually found a vial on the airplane itself. And, of course, then we had the case of Melbourne Airport, where I think it was 56 people were actually hospitalized and thousands were actually got headaches when, again, this mysterious smell. That I wouldn't put that down to a design fault. I would say someone is having a really good job of testing it. And I'm afraid to say that we will probably expect to see more of these airlines going down. But, you know, but the reality is, you know, even if you say, "Hey, man, maybe it's no conspiracy per se," what it does highlight is the world that we've changed in. And, you know, when we turn around and we say to people things like MH70 were hacked or MH370 was hacked, and we go, "Oh, no, that's a conspiracy theory." It's like, wake up! We're living in an entire world where we've got. You look online, you'll find you've got furnace works that are being hacked and destroyed with millions of dollars because someone's gone in there and done things. We saw the Stuknooks with the uranium nuclear plant. We've seen this potentially happen in Fukushima. We've certainly seen it happen in more recently in South Korea. And again, look at that virus. Stuknook has a very specific, we know that the Israelis created Stuknook. So how does an Israeli virus get into a South Korean nuclear plant? That's a very good question right there as well. And we also know that, you know, let's go back to that again, that interesting one, because, of course, everyone's Stuknook was the one that actually occurred. But if you go back a year earlier, you've got the pipeline that was attacked in Turkey. And again, they physically shut down the pipeline. So what we're actually seeing is we're seeing an escalation of cyber warfare where it's not just data being attacked, it's actually the ability to reach out and cause physical damage. Of course, the person that you know is the best example of this is Michael Hastein, killed in 2013. Cyber hacks are actually doing physical, not just data, but physical. I would like to get into the whole MH370 and M370 because I think I've actually found some really new angle, interesting stuff about that. Unfortunately, my hour's actually up. I've got a whole bunch of different guests on board, but what I'm actually going to promise you guys all here is that I'm going to bring in a specialist I know that's on cyber expert. I'm also going to bring in an aviation specialist I know. We're going to go back and we're going to have a little talk about that. We're going to talk about the geopolitics and how what's happening with there also connects to what's happening with the Charlie Hebdo game. My apologies, I forgot my French pronunciation. But we'll have to do that another time because our time is up, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. Our first show, Evan was here today. That was meant to be but she got delayed in Cyberland. Maybe they hacked you. But hopefully we'll provide you lots of interesting material. Again, go check out my website, www.postmanproductions.org. It's got the Facebook site there. I'd update it weekly. The site's just going off like you wouldn't believe it. Until then, though, until next week, all I can say is have a happy new year and good night. Or I should say, in other words, good night, good luck, New Zealand.